Our next segment is a panel discussion. I would like to request the panelists to come forward, Dr. Nadeem Afridi, Dr. Thomas Ghaziano, Mr. Sanjeev Puri, Dr. Anila Azhar, and Dr. Rashid Juma will actually join us through the video conference. Please let me introduce our moderator, Dr. Nadeem Afridi. Dr. Afridi chaired Pakistan's first non-communicable diseases commission in May of 2009 with the government of Pakistan. Thank you. He is the founding president of Public Health Foundation of Pakistan and is also the president-elect 2011 for the Association of Pakistani Descent Cardiologists of North America. Currently, Dr. Nadeem Afridi is an instructor in medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School. I now call upon Dr. Afridi to continue the proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum to our guests. With your permission, Congress Chairman, Ambassador Haqqani, I would first sort of lay down the groundwork of as to how the next 1 hour or 1.5 hour we're going to proceed, since I'm also moderating this session. But before we do that, I wanted to sort of highlight why we chose health as a reason to discuss in this meeting, and why this collaboration between our counterparts in U.S. And in Pakistan is an important one, as we know that there is a strong linkage between diseases, ill health, and economic productivity. In addition, we have also found out evidence that ill health and economic hardships lead to young children leaving schools where they have to work for their parents in a very low socioeconomic environment. And we have plenty of the low-income people. We have about 100 million people who are making under $1,000 a year. So we thought it would be an opportune moment to be able to address this in the larger perspective. The rules, the way this is going to play out is that for the first half hour, I'm going to be talking about health in Pakistan in general from a public health perspective. Then I'm going to get in our speaker from Pakistan, Professor Juma, who is the Director General of Health, and he is going to spend some time talking about policy initiatives. Then I'll get Dr. Ghaziano to come over, and then Anila to come over, and then our esteemed guests from the Mr. Sanjeev Puri to come over to talk. After that, we will sit down, and I will sort of guide the conversation between the groups as to how we see healthcare issues, issues of education, the relationships between Pakistani Americans and the Indian Americans, how should they play out, so that we are able to have a constructive dialogue that leads to some concrete initiatives between Pakistan and the United States. And then we'll have an opportunity to have the guests who are here to come and talk, pose some questions, maybe short comments, and we get some constructive dialogue going. So, briefly speaking, what is the state of health of Pakistan and its citizens? We know that we are 170 million strong. About 100 million of us actually are earning less than $1,500 a year. And about 17 to 20% of our population is actually affluent enough to be able to send their children to school and get good health education. If you look at the health indicators, we have some of the highest infant mortality and maternal mortality, such that of the 4 million births that happened, we lost about 400,000 kids this year. Actually, the data is from 2006. And of those mothers who delivered, we lost about 11,000 mothers during the time of pregnancy. In addition, we have some of the largest infectious disease burdens in terms of tuberculosis, malaria, hepatitis, such that there are rumors that we are beginning to be called a cirrhotic state, which is when the liver gets hardened. So that's how we are being called in some communities. So with this in mind, the thought would be that we would be spending more money on healthcare.
We just want to make everyone aware that the team in Islamabad, through video conferencing, they can see us, they can also listen to us. But for now, we won't have them on the screen. During the discussion, we will bring the screen up. However, they are listening and they can see us.
Welcome, Professor Juma and the team up there. Sorry, I was not able to see you before. Now I can. We are going to be talking about healthcare in Pakistan and some of its indicators. So coming up with how do you track what is happening in Pakistan in terms of its funding? So currently we're spending something of the order of $2.4 billion a year on our health. And 20% of that money comes from the government, and 80% of that money is actually out of pocket by the patients in the country. And about 30% of the population is in touch with a physician or some form of physicians at any given point of time. Now, of those 20% of that $2.4 billion that the government spends, 50% of that money is spent by the government on the army, its families, and some of the non-governmental organizations such as the Pakistan Railways and PIA, and other. The rest of the money is spent out of pocket, and 80% of that out-of-pocket expense by these, by the rest of the 140 million people or so, is actually spent on medications. Then the question is that: are we spending enough on our population or not? And then again, if you're making $1,500 or less, there's no way people have enough money to afford a pill. Which brings us to the next topic, which is the link between poverty and ill health. When a earning person gets sick in a family, they obviously cannot go to work. And then the children have to leave homes, and they are able to bring some money home, and some of them actually do not make enough, so that this group of people are actually spending more of percentage of their income on health, and in the end, they're becoming even more poor. So this vicious cycle of poverty and ill health continues on and on. And Pakistan does not have a public health safety net. So 17% of our population enjoys all the benefits that the government can provide them. But the rest of the population really does not have a safety net. There are no insurance policies, so much of this money is spent through their pockets. And if you look at how are we training our physicians, 97 to 98% of our people that are being trained are trained for diagnosing diseases, or they are trained to treat diseases. But on a population-wide basis, nobody is studying what is happening to our population in terms of how sick they are getting, what kind of diseases are spreading, and how do we tackle that? The government is spending less than a percentage of their healthcare expenditure in that area, and Professor Juma can correct me if I'm off by a few percentage points. We are embarking on a project to create some public health awareness by starting up a foundation that would train experts in this field to be able to catch up with the other part of healthcare which sort of affects the populations of our country. With that, I'm going to stop, and I'm going to introduce Professor Rashid Juma. Currently, he's the Director General Health Services for the Government of Pakistan. He's a consultant neurosurgeon at Aga Khan University. He has trained both in the United States and Great Britain. He's the National Coordinator of Primary Trauma Care. He's the Principal Investigator of Road Traffic Injury Research. He's the Vice Chairman of Governor's Advisory Group on Road Safety. And he's a Counselor of the Pakistan Medical and Dental Council. Can we get Professor Juma online?
Good morning or good evening, Nadeem. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Professor Juma.
So I've had the opportunity to hear Congressman Tierney, and we've had the opportunity to hear your talk as well. I have with me a colleague whom I'll introduce as we go along. I wanted to just briefly make a presentation, a PowerPoint presentation, on what the Pakistan national health policy looks like. We've been working on this for some months now, and it's finally coming to closure. And I'd just like to share the highlights of this with you, if I may. So if we can move to the PowerPoint. And I'm going to try and sort of do this quickly so that we can still have a few minutes left to discuss and then get my colleagues in as well.
Can we pull up the PowerPoint that he sent?
Next. So obviously the vision of the policy would be directed to improving the quality of life of all Pakistanis, but we're particularly interested in trying to get a better achievement in the area of women and child health so as to address Millennium Development Goals. Next slide, please. The big problem that we see that is hampering achieving these goals is barriers to access affordable and essential health services, and these are the barriers that we wish to address. Next slide, please. What's been important for us as we made this policy was to be able to get this to resonate with the provincial health department. And indeed, in the last 2 months, we've been consulting with the provincial health departments and their governments to try and get a synergy between their ideas of health programming and ours. Next slide, please. There are six objectives, and I don't want you to read this because I'm going to address these one by one. Next slide, please. The first objective is the development of an essential health services package. And this is a theme that will keep coming back through this presentation, and this is really the cornerstone of what we've been trying to do. This, in essence, what we propose is that we need to define a minimum package of services that the system can afford and the system can deliver. And once we have that, to be able to guarantee that or guarantee access to those services for all citizens. The challenges we face, of course, are poor infrastructure and resource constraints. Next slide, please. But to address those challenges, Our priority actions for this first item is to develop this package, to cost it and prioritize it as we've done right now. And then we work with individual provinces to make sure that all of them can adopt a package that is germane to their condition and suitable to their implementing mechanisms. Next slide, please. The second objective that we need to address is the human resource development, because quite honestly, if you look at the performance of the state sector in health, the reason there is this tremendous mismatch mentioned by Dr. Afridi of 80% out of pocket and just 20% from the state is that we don't have the people to deliver the services. With a great dearth of nurses, midwives, physicians, particularly women physicians in the rural area. What we want to do and what we are doing right now, we have a major exercise which is just rolling out to do an inventory of the human resource situation on the ground. And we've, as I said, in our as we work up our essential health services package, we want to also forecast the requirements and try and bridge the gap by recruitment, by training, and probably more important, by task substitution. And that's what that inverted commas expression in the third bullet about physician expanders are. It is apparent to the health ministry that if we're waiting for physicians to do this job, it's like waiting for Godot. And we really need to be able to substitute them by people who are trained in a lesser degree, but a more focused. Next slide, please. The third item is our health information management system. We've had a health information system for some years, but it does not coherently provide us with the data in a timely fashion that would allow us to, A, have a good sense of what's happening in the country, but second, in a way that is comprehensive to be allow evidence-based decision-making. So what we want to do here is to improve our information platform by devolving it to a district information system. And this is something that we've started on with a colleague and international donor partners. The Japanese have been very helpful in this. And we're hoping that within a year or so, the DHIS will have gone across in all districts, and we'll be able to get real-time information on what's happening in terms of diseases and in terms of burden of non-communicable and communicable conditions. This, incidentally, is a requirement of the international health regulations as well, so a lot of people are quite interested to see how we get on with this over the next year. Next slide. One of the things that hampers the delivery of services in our state system is that there is a lack of appropriate health technology, and by that I mean diagnostic testing, medication, biological agents such as vaccine, and then of course equipment and specialist services. So one of the things that we're trying to do, and this is where we need the collaboration of our provincial and district partners, is we'd like to make an inventory of what is available, and we want to then work towards bridging the gaps. Next slide. And one of the most important things that I see, and I tell myself that if there was one thing that I could do to better the health system, I would have a good biomedical engineering system. Pakistan's health, public health facilities are graveyards of equipment. We buy equipment, we use them for a week, and then they're put away in a store because something's not working, or the person who knows how to use it is not there. And we want to create a medical device policy, and link that to a service to provide biomedical maintenance, for preventive maintenance, and reparative services. Can I just say that of all the things that I've said in the provinces, this is the one where their eyes light up and they nod their heads vigorously and say, yes, we need this. Because this is a great deficiency in our system. Next slide. Clearly, all of this requires budgeting. And as we work with the provincial health departments and the district health departments, we would like to be able to also work with them what is a realistic budget to be able to deliver these services, to employ the right mix of people, to service your equipment, to provide with provide all the inputs that a health system requires. And clearly, it is only when we're able to get the budget rationalized and then, of course, provide it, would we be able to meet the mismatch between private and public spending. Next slide, please. So that's what we're seeking to do, is to define and allocate budgets according to packages. And our commitment to the provincial health departments has been that the federal government will work with you to bridge the gap. And I can tell you, as we come to the last objective, that, next slide, please. As we come to the last objective, that this requires good governance. And I'm sitting with you, I'm sitting and talking to you from Karachi today, having come down this evening. I'm not in Islamabad, so I can be a little frank and say that governance is a great challenge to deliver good services in Pakistan right now. But what I can tell you is that at the level of decision-making, the commitment to actually do this is very strong. I can tell you, quite frankly, that we've had a number of occasions to glean the thinking of the decision-makers in Pakistan. The will and the commitment is there, but I think that they're stymied by the system. And we need to improve governance and at all levels and all tiers. And we can do this by making sure that the old culture of patronage and pilferage and waste goes away. And can I move to the next slide? And I've shown this slide in all the health departments of this country and in the federal government. And I want to draw your attention to the last bullet, where everybody that I've presented this to has concurred and nodded their heads and said yes, and that is we need to insulate the healthcare services for political influence or patronage. If there's one big stumbling block in its being able to realize its potential, it is this. And my plea at every opportunity that I can make this plea is that the two big social services, health and education, should be positively insulated from political influence and patronage. I just want to say that, as I conclude, that we feel that Pakistan needs to get away from thinking big in terms of urban centers, big tertiary care hospitals, big pieces of equipment, to delivering primary health care at the doorstep. And we aim to do this by providing an essential health service package. And just a quick example, next slide, please, of what sort of thing we would like to do, the sets of services. They, of course, vary country by country according to resources. And a good example of this, for instance, at the first care facility level would be just antenatal services, nutritional advice and intervention, and looking after children in an integrated way to make sure that the young infants and the under five and the diseases that afflict them are well taken care of. And of course, we don't need to have very fancy equipment at these first level facilities, just vaccines and basic anti-infection medication. The personnel, we would like to have doctors, but as I mentioned earlier, this can be done in other ways, and there are many other countries around the world that have shown this. So I would like to end here, but Nadeem, I want to ask you if I can just get a word in from my colleague to my left, who is Dr. Aziz Tang, who has for many years represented the Pakistan Medical Association, and to my right is an emergency room physician in Pakistan.
Can we have the picture back, please?
And Dr. Umrana, who spends all her life trying to better the care of mothers and children in remote districts. Naveen?
Yes, Dr. Umrana, please go ahead and have your colleague give us his views or her views.
I'm thankful to Dr. Professor Ovi Juma for bringing me with him and asking me, and you have also requested regarding the Pakistan Medical Association's point of view regarding the health problems. He has rightly, you see, mentioned and pointed out the basic problem in this country last 50 to 60 years is the primary health care. And the unless and until the primary health care is addressed, it's not going to serve any purpose. And we have learned the lesson during all these periods that unless and until we give attention to the primary health care, and which, as you have already mentioned, the diseases which are prevalent in this country, right from the infant mortality rate, maternal mortality rate, and various diseases from the cholera to the TB and other such diseases, which all comes under the purview of the primary health care. And unless until they are addressed, and unless, as mentioned by Professor Juma, who also happens to be the DG Health, that unless and until we pay attention to the all these programs regarding the vaccines, and the basic healthcare necessities, we cannot improve our health system. In the past, you see, the U.S. aid helped to establish the basic certain institutions like the BMSI at JPMC, and I had the occasion to work under the late Professor Juma, who was there at the JPMC for some time. And these were the very good institutions. So unless until we establish such type of the institutions and train our manpower, as rightly mentioned by them, unless, you see, we have not to think regarding to build the castles in the air. We don't want the Taj Mahal and other things like that, but we want the basic at the grassroots level for our rural people. Unless and until 70% of the population is served, as rightly mentioned by Professor Juma, again I mentioned that at the district level.
I'm going to interrupt you, Professor Juma, if I could interrupt for 1 second.
We are short
of time, and we're going to proceed with, and we're going to try and get some more discussion as we move towards the discussion part of this meeting. I'm going to invite Dr. Thomas Gaziano. He's the assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School in the Division of Cardiovascular Medicine. He has a secondary appointment at the Department of Health Policy Management at Harvard School of Public Health. He's a co-principal investigator of the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute, the Ovation Center of Excellence for Chronic Diseases in South Africa. He's also a co-director of the Harvard Initiative for Global Health Cardiovascular Working Group. And we also now have the pleasure of having to have him collaborate with us in Pakistan for our initiative on non-communicable disease in a project in Karachi. Please welcome Dr. Thomas Gaziano.
Thank you, Nadeem, and thank you to Irfan and the members of the Extension, the Harvard Extension International Relations Club, for inviting me and allowing me to have the opportunity to participate in this conference. I'm actually quite impressed that the health was and education were considered fundamental parts of an understanding both in the U.S.-Pakistani relationship, but also in terms of the development of the country, and as ours as well, because we see that these should be, as Congressman Tierney addressed earlier, a two-way relationship where we have things to learn from each other. And I've seen that experience in our centers of excellence in South Africa, where we're importing ideas that we developed there back into the U.S. Nadeem had asked me to address a or discuss a couple topics. One, I'm going to talk about the global burden of disease, particularly as it relates to non-communicable diseases. I'm going to give, starting at a larger sort of view of the world, moving down to the South Asian region, and even some of the discussions about Pakistan and the issues around blood pressure as an example. And then I want to move on to some of the economic burden, where I sort of move from being the doctor and the epidemiologist to the public health official and understanding what the potential economic burdens are as well related to chronic diseases. And then discuss what are some of the ways that many of the developed countries have dealt with this problem, what similarities there may be with regards to how the Pakistanis can deal with the problems of non-communicable diseases, and where there are significant differences and challenges that will need to be investigated. But I would probably like to start with a little bit of humility, as what should always guide these types of discussions. And that is a discussion, you know, particularly around and how they look at the impact of health and foreign relations and peace, particularly striking, as well as the general well-being of a population. I'll give you the example of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was president during the Second World War. And it was noted that at the meeting in Yalta, where he was meeting with Churchill and Stalin and the discussions of what Europe was potentially going to look like at the conclusion of the Second World War, that his blood pressure was 260 over 120. And many of you may not understand what that value means. We look at people having a blood pressure of maybe 120, 140 as being normal. He was nearly two times that. Currently, if somebody would measure with that blood pressure, whether it's in Pakistan here, they'd be admitted to hospital, immediately treated, and lowered the blood pressure and having continuous levels of medication. President Roosevelt had blood pressures like this for several years prior to the Yalta Conference, and many people suggest that his concentration due to this high levels of blood pressure were deeply affected at these meetings. He ultimately died of a stroke related to his high blood pressure about a month later, and obviously the rest of the war was carried out by President Truman. And so there's significant impacts at the international level and security issues related to health as one example. The humility part comes into it as his doctor, as a Harvard doctor, cardiologist like me, from Mass General Hospital, our competing institution where Nadim is from, not at the Brigham, but nonetheless, he was one of the world's renowned cardiologists in the world who said that we should not treat his blood pressure because this was a reaction to other heart conditions that he had, and this was compensatory. We've now since learned from the studies that were done here in Massachusetts, the Framingham Heart Studies, that actually blood pressure precedes disease and that we should be aggressive about treating it. So that we learn some humility that we don't always know what is right, and it takes some time. And some of the academic studies and research requires us to do that. And there are impacts at the personal level as well as the international level related to heart disease. Global burden of disease, and Nadim had mentioned some of our speakers, Dr. Juma, had mentioned some of the problems with infectious diseases and child and infant mortality. These are significant problems globally. But globally, non-communicable diseases are responsible for 60% of our deaths worldwide. There's a nonprofit organization called 3-4-50, and they talk about three risk factors. Poor nutritional choices, tobacco, and physical inactivity lead to four diseases: cardiovascular disease, cancer, chronic lung respiratory diseases, and diabetes, which are responsible for over 50% of deaths. So 3-4-50. And we say, well, the general myth is that most of these diseases or problems occur in high-income countries, and they're problems of affluent countries. Well, that's also a myth. The Global Burden of Disease projects show that it is cardiovascular disease in alone of those chronic diseases, the number one cause of death globally, representing about 30% of deaths. 80% of those chronic cardiovascular disease deaths occur in low- and middle-income countries, not in the high-income countries. Every region of the world, with the exception of sub-Saharan Africa, it is a leading cause of death. The South Asian region, where Pakistan is represented according to the World Bank regions, it is about 25% of deaths. So it's a significant problem globally. The other challenge, now I'm going to move away from the health side, but sort of look at the economic or the social consequences of this disease. And Nadim addressed some of these. But the healthcare is an expensive, obviously, proposition. We're dealing and grappling with that in the United States Congress right now. And Professor Tierney may not be reminded of that, but that's obviously a significant challenge in this country. But it's an important part of the economy. It's an important part of the health and well-being of the population. But one thing we've done in the developed world is pushed out when this disease occurs to a later age. But if you look at countries like India and South Africa, and the ages between 35 to 64, many people think about the prime working years life, 10% of heart disease or heart attacks occur in that age group. In the developing countries, 40% of the heart attacks occur among the 35 to 64-year-olds. So four times the rate in the prime working years of our country occurs during this time period, heart attacks and strokes in particular. So this has profound economic and productivity consequences. Next, I want to learn to discuss where have we gone in terms of what are the overall costs. So healthcare in, say, Pakistan for blood pressure alone, $150 million, if we're to be consistent with guidelines, would be what would be required to maintain one risk factor of many risk factors for cardiovascular disease. And so there's potentially, as we move towards deciding to tackle some of these problems, we have to understand what the potential economic consequences are, as well as what the benefits would be in terms of improving productivity. How do we get into this state? Well, most of the developed countries over the last 170 years or so, around the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, went through a slow, what we call epidemiological transition. At the same time, economic and social developments were occurring. As education was improving, the infrastructure to support industry were developing, so were changes in improvements, particularly public health improvements, establishments of improving water supplies, setting up vaccination programs later on in that sort of transition in the middle part of last century as the vaccines were beginning to develop. But we saw reductions in the infectious diseases such as malaria, tuberculosis, not AIDS is an issue now, but other infectious diseases that were influenza in particular at those periods. And then a rapid increase as we controlled that and improved the food supply, we started developing some what we call the second stage, or the third stage, the man-made diseases, where not only we had control of infectious disease, but now we were hurting ourselves. We're producing rapid increase in production of tobacco, easier access to foods that are high in saturated fats, such as an increased meat and dairy products, and decreasing in physical activity as we were moving from an agrarian lifestyle to an industrial lifestyle. So these are significant trends that happened over 150 years. Fortunately, in the 1950s or 60s, the most industrial countries, we recognized that we were creating a different problem. We've taken care of infectious disease, but now we're having people dying, particularly of heart disease and cancer. And some of these were things that had initiated or put upon ourselves. So through aggressive research through the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute in particular for cardiovascular disease, studies of the Framingham Heart Study, we began to realize that we had significant risk factors that we were imposing upon ourselves. As a result of that, we had a 50% reduction in chronic disease rates over the last 50 years. So what we're trying to do is understand, and through these centers of excellence that the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute has funded through about a $45 million gift to 11 centers around the world, India, in Bangladesh, South Africa, China, Latin American countries have all been invested and linked with other developed country institutions, mostly U.S., but not all, to address and see what we've learned from what happened in the developed countries. Dealing with non-communicable diseases can then be passed on into these other countries. And that's where we are moving in terms of trying to understand what would be the potential linkages and improvements that we can see as what's cost-effective. Clearly, I think what's going to be important in these areas is an investment in the public health infrastructure, which is delivery of healthcare in general, population-based strategies to control smoking, consumption of fats and salts, but also an investment in the personalized delivery of care. And those are some of the things that were addressed in Dr. Juma's areas, you know, what particular areas, what would be an essential care package to deal with both chronic diseases as well as some of the original burdens of infectious disease and women and child health. Thank you.
Tom, thank you. That was very helpful. And then because of the time issues, and I'm going to go ahead and we will introduce both Anila and Mr. Puri in a little bit, but we want to start with some discussions. Could I invite Ambassador Haqqani to join us so that we can get some sort of ideas going as to what to do in terms of health, and I'm going to pose a sort of couple of general questions. Could you please join us up here? No, we just want, just sit with us.
If it's any good to you, I feel about the same.
And we know that there is a large dearth of healthcare providers in the country. That is Pakistan. And we also know that to develop such institutions of public health in the country, to be able to help our people, that 117 to 120 million population, we really need to upgrade those areas. And we also know that education, not just medical education, but education in general, is extremely important for the development of the country, not only at the higher levels, but at the elementary level and at the secondary level. Maybe I would start with by asking this question with Congressman Tierney as to how does he sees this relationship progress between Pakistan and U.S., especially in areas of health and education, and I know Congressman has done some work in these in education.
Well, thank you very much, Doctor. I think it's going to be up to Pakistan, obviously, to decide what direction they want to go. We've been trying to be helpful in the education field and making sure that we provide resources for alternative schools that will allow the government to teach civic responsibility and all the necessary subjects for people to have the ability to seize on opportunity and have a decent life. On the healthcare, you're starting off in a situation where you'll be in a different perspective than the United States, which formed their healthcare process after World War II, during World War II, when healthcare was basically provided as an option because we couldn't raise salaries. There was a freeze on salaries, and as many of you well know, we ended up in the insurance situation that we're in today with a lot of employers providing health insurance for their employees. Pakistan is at a threshold area where they can decide how they want to deliver healthcare. That'll be one of the larger policy debates they have, whether they want to set up an insurance-based system, whether they want to have something on a single-payer type of option, or just how they want to proceed. That'll have great economic consequences for them in the way they get the most mileage for the dollars invested on that. I think our role as the United States is just to work with Pakistan to provide resources where that's amenable to try and I think we have a heavy emphasis on knowing that education and healthcare are two areas where you can do the most good about buttressing your civil society, and we've tried over time to have a balance between understanding the security issues that are there, but really believing that heavy investments have to be made in development, in education, in healthcare, in order for the country to prosper. So that'll be our role, basically, trying to be supportive on that in any way that we can, but allowing Pakistan, of course, to make the decisions and decide how they want to structure those areas.
More importantly, I was wondering if you could comment on the collaborative models, where we don't have to have our own learning curves from the 40s to the 2009. U.S. has had its own curve of development in health, similarly in health education and education in general. And there are some very institutions in the USA and the manpower and the linkages that we need to create between those groups of people. It's not about money, actually. It's more about trying to learn and expedite that phase of learning and going to the next stage rather than having your own learning curve. So from that perspective, I wanted to see if some bridges could be built between the two countries.
Well, we know that there are some bridges that are being built in institutions that are having a presence in Pakistan now and inviting folks back and forth, and I think those types of exchanges are critical. And on in your own organization, the Pakistani Physicians of New England and others like that, to the extent that they can increase their role and play the intermediary on that and provide their services and insight and experience in Pakistan is phenomenal. And I think we have to encourage that. I know that Ambassador Holbrook was in touch with the group after you and I and the group met. I went back to Ambassador Holbrook and discussed with him the need to engage the Pakistani community in America to go over, particularly physicians and people in specialty fields on that basis. I think that holds true in education, of getting academic exchanges, student exchanges on that, and in the healthcare industry. And I think that that will play out depending on how much attention people that are here, like your physicians groups, really want to engage and participate. From what I've seen, early indications are that there's a serious interest in that, and I think that'll have a tremendous impact.
I was wondering if our panel has any questions from a policy perspective, and then maybe one or two questions for Congressman from the audience.
How extraordinary that we answered all the questions in such a short period of time.
All right. Coming, sort of following through the educational system, and I know Anila has done a lot of work in this area. She's at Johns Hopkins. And I was just wondering whether there are ways that we could bring, not the higher education, I know there's a lot of emphasis on higher education, a lot of money is being spent. What can be done with our positions here in the U.S. in terms of the primary education system development, secondary education system development? As you know, whatever plagues the healthcare in Pakistan in terms of funding, we have the similar, we are spending less than a percentage of our GDP on education, especially primary, secondary, and education. And in addition, the education is sort of garnered towards those 70% of the population who are either government servants or belong to the army, but the rest of the population, about 130 million or so, really do not have access to good or quality education. And maybe if you want to sort of highlight some of those issues and see if you can engage Dr. Congressman Tierney from that perspective.
Health education is definitely not my area of expertise, but I have some ideas about it.
This is primarily from general education.
In relation to general education. So there are a lot of, you know, creative projects being done in Pakistan at the grassroots level by different NGOs and community-based organizations. And I think that they can collaborate with people who are working in education in other developing countries as well as in the technologically advanced countries to think about models of health education that can be incorporated in the curriculum at the elementary and middle school level. And then we can also employ these technologies very creatively just to make people aware of the diseases and the prevention measures that you were talking about. So it could be included in the formal as well as the non-formal curriculum.
If I can just interject for a second here, one of the difficulties we have is we've done a lot of research in pre-K all the way through 12th grade now, and we think that we know a lot of things that should be done that we have not been doing historically mm-hmm. in the past. Obviously, one of the more important things is teacher development on that. How can the United States help Pakistan in making sure that they have teacher development at the level they wanted and bring enough teachers in at those levels so it really makes an impact?
Just developing good teacher education programs, professional development, in-service professional development programs for educators and teachers, and conducting rigorous research to look at the effectiveness of those programs. And I'm aware of many projects, collaborative projects that are being undertaken in Pakistan, by the people here, faculty members here, researchers here, in collaboration with people who are working in Pakistan. So yes, this professional development component can be developed and strengthened.
I want to add, and this is a question I think directed everyone in the panel. I don't want to put Congressman Tierney on the spot because I think it's a question I don't know if anybody knows the answer. But one of the things that I think that whether the U.S. government is involved in, and I agree with him that it's not our decision, but the priority setting in general with regards to health and education in Pakistan, what percentage of its government expenditure ought it be? We do know in two facts that there's a correlation between the percentage of GDP spent and the health of nations and the GDP of the country itself. A pretty linear relationship. So as countries become wealthier, more is devoted towards healthcare, and the population becomes healthier. And what that relationship is, what is the chicken or the egg? What is leading? Does investment in health lead to improvement in economic development? Probably at some level, maybe at 18 to 20%, maybe not. in terms of where we are in the U.S. At some point, maybe it cripples economic development. But there is some correlation between developed and developing countries where investments in health leads to improvements in economic development. There was a study that was just done, it was released in Davos at the World Economic Forum, where they looked at different things that were potential to lead to financial or lead to economic instability or changes in GDP growth. And non-communicable diseases was higher than financial crises as a likelihood of having an impact on global economic development. So I think that those are some questions that need to be at least addressed. Perhaps some of the aid that comes to Pakistan can help alleviate some of those questions or take pressure off of the Pakistani government making that. But I think it's a long-term question that has to be addressed. How much do we get, what's the return on education investment and what's the return on health investment?
Well, one of the interesting dilemmas that that raises, of course, is you saw all of the consternation that came around supposedly the United States infringing on sovereignty in Pakistan when we put conditions on the military money. One of the things we tried to do in the Kerry-Lugar bill was be very clear that it was $1.5 billion per year over the next 5 years going and civilian reinforcements on that without conditions. We were trying to really signal our long-term commitment and a strategic partnership and understanding from our perspective that, yes, we understand the whole security question, but having had experiences not all good in Iraq and Afghanistan and everywhere else, we believe that there was a real fundamental issue of making sure that the civilian government had the capacity to make the investments that would get the public behind the civilian government and move in a democratic way toward improving the life situation. So we put that $1.5 billion out there without conditions. On the other hand, we want to make sure that we do have some perspective and experience and information on how best it is moved, that there has to be a heavy investment in education. And that's why I did the amendment that moved $75 million more into that, not trying to micromanage so much, but to give the tools to the civilian government to say, like, look, I think everybody understands the importance of education and that it has to be a broad education. It can't just be channeled on a religious basis. It has to be a broad education that's going to really give people a foundation to impact positively the society, and then try to steer money also into health care and into all of those types of issues. We do that both on the private sector, you know, the Gates Foundation, Clinton Foundation, and others, where we try to make sure that those monies are targeted there. But even in the policy, sometimes without micromanaging and without trying to have a heavy hand, say, look, we're a friend and we're trying to have a strategic relationship here. We really believe that you have to make a heavy investment on the civilian side, and we think that, you know, as much as development of roads and energy and other areas, it has to be education, it has to be health care. That's fundamental and builds it up. So it's that fine line between being seen as actually coming in and trying to tell people what to do or whatever, as opposed to being a partner and saying, we're going to give you resources here and put some in some areas at least to say we think that's a good direction to go, but do that as a partner, as an equal, and as a friend based on the research that we know. It's the same thing we're trying to do in our country. So we try to strike that balance and move it in that direction.